Hey guys, how's it going? All right, well, that's good. Or sorry to hear that, or whichever applies to you best, you know, whatever. Anyway. Welcome to my radio show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Here, I complain about American foreign policy. Oh, and I interview journalists. Well, and you know, commentators. Opinion havers. Yeah. So, I got a new compressor because I had two compressors before and half of both of them didn't work anymore. And there's this buzz. And I swear to you, a couple weeks ago, I unplugged a bunch of things to figure out where the buzz was coming from. And when I unplugged the one of the compressors, the buzz went away. So I says, oh, that was it. So I went and got a new compressor. And got rid of the other two. And then the buzz was still there. Huh? But it wasn't the new compressor buzzing. It was the power supply for the mixing board. Really? All right, well, so I ordered a new one of those. I needed a new compressor anyway. But the point is, I may sound funny to you today. I don't know. Do I sound different? Am I being compressed different? I did some sound checks and stuff. Should be tuned up good. Check, check. Is that working well? All right, good. It was the power supply for the mixing board. God, I'm such an idiot. Oh, well. I need a new compressor anyway. About time. Those things are 10 years old. All right, so, yeah, things. I got Peter Van Buren. He's going to be on the show to talk about the Israelis and the Saudis and the Americans and the Iranians. And, you know, I also have an invite out to a couple of Phils. One's Giraldi and the other is Weiss. And I also have an invite out to this lady who wrote a bunch of stuff about Somalia. And I also have an invite out to Trevor Aronson, who wrote this great thing for The Intercept. Did you read that? About how apparently the FBI's expert witness in their bogus entrapment cases, who says, oh yeah, no, this guy totally, he's a terrorist, man, because I'm an expert and I say so. Apparently he works for the FBI, not just as an expert witness. But maybe that's his role as an undercover agent, is a pretend expert. Well, I'm extrapolating a bit much. It's all very, very classified, but there's a bunch of lawyers trying to get it all declassified. Very important story. Would that even be a scandal in 2015 America right now if it came out that the FBI's expert witness in all their entrapment cases was an FBI undercover informant or officer who was just pretending to be separate from the police who were prosecuting the case? I don't know. It might not be, right? I mean, we're talking about a bunch of nobody idiots who were entrapped by somebody, by a well-paid FBI informant, or a well-threatened one, into basically nothing. Most of the case, just saying they love Osama on a videotape or some ridiculous crap. So, if that wasn't scandalous enough to cause a problem, then I don't know. Maybe all the prosecution witnesses are FBI agents. Undercover and otherwise. Boy, if I was ever on a jury, I would vote to acquit. Well, maybe not, but probably. Yeah, I don't believe in things government says. All right, anyway. Oh, yeah, police state section here. All right, Rand Paul. Rand Paul. So, here's his thing. He's an idiot. And in his big chance to cross-examine John Kerry in the Iran hearings last week, says, the Ayatollah says that the Iran deal doesn't even stop him from making nukes. Yeah, he says that. He says that. He kept insisting this over and over. And Kerry, I guess at first was didn't really understand just how full of it Rand was. He seemed a bit confused. And then he finally said, "No, Rand, you stupid idiot." What he said was that he had already banned nukes. So the deal wasn't what prevented them from making nuclear weapons. His fatwa was. And Rand says, "Oh, no further questions." You pathetic idiot. The Americans say they stopped Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. They know it's not true. We had a fatwa declaring nuclear weapons to be religiously forbidden under Islamic law. It had nothing to do with the nuclear talks. That's the quote of the Ayatollah. And then after being corrected by Kerry, he went on TV and he used the same damn talking point again. What's that mean? That means that Rand Paul is a liar. A ridiculous one. That means that he is focused on the strategy. Well, there's a certain segment of right-wing talk radio audience, ridiculous idiots, who only believe things that aren't true, and so I have to give them something. So I'll just give them this. They'll like it. And if someone explains to them the whole context is the exact opposite of what Rand says it is, they won't believe it. And then he'll win, I don't know, 16 more votes somewhere, maybe. Pretty sure that's the plan. Complete idiocy. And then, get this, at Politico.com, this story is Inside Rand Paul's Downward Spiral. He was once a serious contender for the White House. Now his campaign is fighting over what went wrong. I will say as a disclaimer, the debates haven't started yet. He could go out there and be a hero and destroy them all in the debates, but is that what you think is going to happen? So they say morale has begun to sink at campaign headquarters. One key aide recently departed. Others have had conversations with rival campaigns. It's such a negative environment, one Paul aide said. Everyone is on edge. No one is having any fun. They need to recapture some of their positive mojo and fast. But then, and I guess I'm not certain whether this is just Politico talking or whether this is the, you know, conclusion of the Paul campaign. Is this what they figured out so far? Get this. His theory of the 2016 primary, that Republican voters would reward a candidate who promised fresh ideas and an unconventional approach, has not borne out in reality. Huh? All he's done is move from his father's position of right on everything that is completely unconventional to horrible on everything that is absolutely mediocre and mainstream and indistinguishable from Mike Huckabee. Indistinguishable from Rick Perry. Except for his little perm. And his little turtleneck sweater. That's what's failed. Throwing his father under the bus on everything. His father, who's awesome. By the way, here's Ron Paul in BuzzFeed. This guy, BuzzFeed Andrew, has decided he's going to fisk everything that Ron Paul says and anything controversial that Ron Paul says he's going to bring up in order to try to make it scandalous for Rand. In this case, he's using something Ron Paul said on my show. An accident or a false flag will cause economic collapse. And if you read all the quotes, they're actually really great. Inflammatory title, really great substance. Same thing for this other one, where they quote him in the book talking about Zionism and the empire. How will Rand answer? How far under the bus will he throw his father? How sharp will he get his dagger before he sticks it in his father's back? Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. So here's my thing. I think that if Rand Paul has a prayer, it's to be as libertarian as possible. He's got 20 other Republicans up there to be different and better than. And he's got Donald Trump, who's by far the loudest, smack-talkingest, attention-gettingest. So how's he gonna separate himself at all? By crawling on his belly and swearing to God that he's as bad as all of them on everything? No, I swear I'm as bad as them on everything! Look at my value-added tax! Look at my position on Iran. I'm horrible. Republicans love me, he cries. And they don't. And he can't understand it. His only prayer is to go out there and say, all of them think this, and they're crazy and wrong. All of them think this, this, and this. They're crazy and wrong. Oh, they all want to fight for Iran in Iraq, and they all want to fight for Al-Qaeda in Syria. They all want to fight for Al-Qaeda in Yemen, but bomb them, but only create more of them by bombing them in Somalia and Libya, where we used to support, where they used to support them, but now they support the other guy. Whatever. Get up there and just mock and ridicule them all. So, Lindsey Graham, who's your favorite jihadist in Syria? Is it Golani, or is it somebody else, or what? Who do you think ought to be the new dictator of Syria after Assad falls? Caliph Ibrahim? Or Benjamin Netanyahu, is that it? Anyway, just get out there and fight them. Get out there and just say, these guys don't believe in small government. These guys believe in the biggest government in the history of mankind. And not a one of them will roll back a damn thing Obama's done or that Bush Jr. did before them. Repeal the 21st century. Vote Paul. There's a campaign. There's a fight that people will even bother paying attention to. Oh, I swear to God, I'm just as bad on Iran as Charles Krauthammer wants me to be is not a good campaign slogan. No, I'll get your son killed too. Yeah, no, I don't care what's true either. Vote Paul. Who, my dad? The heroic peacemonger, truth teller? Never heard of him. And here's what he is. He's playing, he's Huckabee with a perm right now, Rand Paul is. That's all he's doing. Is playing to the exact same base that Huckabee's playing to. The people who are complete idiots and are always wrong about everything. Huckabee defends his oven remark. He says, oh, the Iran nuclear deal is like marching the Israelis into the ovens of the Holocaust. Oh, God. So then he says, Huckabee defends the comment. Hey, you're an idiot if you don't believe that Iran wants to kill Jews. We're not talking about some wild-eyed blogger. We're talking about the official Iranian government promising, not just threatening, promising that they will kill Jews. That's funny because here's from last week, the leader of Iran's Jewish community ridiculing Benjamin Netanyahu as narcissistic and delusional for insisting on the anti-Semitism of the Iranian government. Of course, Jews have lived in Persia since before Islam was invented. And they're protected there. And there are something like 50,000 of them. And, anyway, he's being ridiculed by the, a leader of the Jewish community in Iran. Oh yeah, they just want to kill us all, which is why 50,000 of us live here in peace. Whatever, dude. And just to prove Huckabee's dishonesty on that same Rand Paulian level, here he is, quoted in the Huffington Post from 2008, supporting talks with Iran and saying, look, we can't deal with Al-Qaeda, but we can deal with Iran. We just got to limit their program and put some tough sanctions on them. And listen, the reality is we have to keep all our allies and the UN Security Council on board with us and everything. And so he just goes on and says all this stuff. We might be able to live with a contained Iran. They will not acquire nuclear weapons. But before I look parents in the eye to explain why I put their son's or daughter's life at risk, I want to do everything possible to avoid conflict. We have substantive issues to discuss with Tehran. That's Mike Huckabee in 2008. Now pretending that this nuclear deal is the Holocaust. Give me a break. And this is even, he's even been corrected by a leader of Likud. Israeli Transport Minister Yisrael Katz said on Facebook the former Arkansas governor was genuinely concerned about Israel's future. But dear Mr. Huckabee, no one is marching Jews to the ovens anymore. This is a member of Netanyahu's right-wing nationalist Likud party. That is why we established the State of Israel and the Israel Defense Forces. And if necessary, we will know how to defend ourselves by ourselves. Oh yeah, no, but guess what? There's a certain percentage of the American population that are complete idiots. You can fool some of the people all the time, and those are the ones you want to concentrate on. Right, Rand Paul? Right, Mike Huckabee? Who don't care what's true at all, but just what they think can advance their ambition by just a little bit. And then I love this from Huckabee, too. I don't expect Rand Paul to be more than a week behind him. Huckabee to Newsmax. Israel is the warm-up act before Iran takes on the U.S. Oh, man, oh, man. I am so scared. You know why? Because I've never seen a globe before. And as far as I know, Iran is some gigantic global superpower that could fight a war against the United States if they wanted to and maybe defeat us. Right? Why not? Oh, because their GDP is a 3,000th of ours or 300th maybe of ours. Because their navy is made of speedboats, aluminum and fiberglass speedboats. Because their air force is F-14s that America sold them in the 1970s and haven't sold them spare parts for since the 1970s. I am just terrified. Anyway, now why Rand thinks that these idiots would prefer him to Huckabee? No idea. The perm, maybe? The blatant disingenuousness? Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Peter Van Buren, writing at tomdispatch.com. He'll be on antiwar.com tomorrow. Washington and Tehran come in from the cold. He's the author of the book, We Meant Well. Before that, he worked for the State Department, was a whistleblower there. We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. That's his book, and that's also his blog at wementwell.com. Welcome back. How are you doing, Peter?
Scott, it's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Yeah, well, I had a good time reading this article this morning. Very important. First of all, overall, what you're saying here is that Iran is rising in power and influence in the region, and Washington has decided to some degree, I guess, get out of the way or decide to go ahead and cooperate with them rather than continually, sticking with the fake nuclear threat as an excuse to contain them forever?
The reality of Iran as a power in the Middle East, in fact, I'd argue alongside the United States, it is the co-dominant power in the Middle East right now, is simply a reality. Whether the United States wants to acknowledge it or not is irrelevant. However, what we are seeing is moves by America finally to do this thing we used to call diplomacy, to try to reach some kind of new relationship with the Iranians. We have seen in the last 2 weeks that the Obama administration, and may lightning not strike me for praising them and John Kerry, the Secretary of State, pull off an agreement with the Iranians to reduce the likelihood that Iran will become a nuclear state. This opens the door to a fuller relationship that does acknowledge the new balance of power in the Middle East, and that's all an important and a good thing.
All right. Now, so what's so new about the balance of power other than America going and getting rid of Saddam and empowering the Shiite majority in Iraq?
Well, those are very important things, and it's useful to trace this back to the, we'll call it the triggering event, which was 2003 when the United States invaded Iran and to a certain extent the invasion of Afghanistan. Don't forget that prior to September 11th, the Iranians had hostile forces on both borders. The Taliban and the Iranians were never friends, and the Iranians were having trouble on that eastern border. And obviously Saddam and the Iranians had been in at literal war for many years in the past, and were in kind of a on and off again semi-hot war, if you will. The United States, in the span of a couple of years, eliminated both external threats to the Iranians, which was something they should really send us, you know, a gift card or a fruit basket for doing for them. Meanwhile, the Iranians had gotten very good and very smart about using their special forces, their financial influence, to send people and create zones of influence, I guess would be the best word, in Syria, in Yemen, in Lebanon, and maybe some other places in the Middle East. The U.S. kicking over the can in Iraq changed Iraq from a Sunni country to a Shia country, which quickly became essentially a client state of the Iranians. All of those things, some of them America's doing, some of them Iran's doing, all shifted the balance of power dramatically in the Middle East. We're just kind of catching up to it now with this new accord.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so Syria and Iran already had a relationship going back. But, when Obama announced, at the beginning, I guess, of the Arab Spring and America and Saudi's attempted hijacking of it, counter-revolution of it in some places, I guess, and hijacking of it in others. What they did in Syria, Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic, that's right, Jeffrey, getting rid of Assad would be a great way to bring Iran down a peg. And so that's what we're trying to do. And so, I'm working on this nuclear deal, but it's not like I love Iran or anything. I agree with you that this is what we need to be doing in Syria in order to weaken their power there. But then I wonder whether you think after these years of war and Assad's still holding on to all the cities, I mean, Idlib is a small town basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has America been basically pushing Assad further into Iran's camp? Has Iranian support for the Assad government, the Syrian military, for Hezbollah fighting alongside them, has the increase that's gone on in this war helped entrench Iranian power in Syria even more than before, or you know, relatively the same, or it's helped erode it? Because after all, the Islamic State and al-Nusra rule most of Syria now in terms of just sheer land territories. So,
well, the Iranians have a number of goals in the Middle East, and it differs from place to place and country to country. I think one of their primary goals is to oppose American power. And that means making deals and supporting people where they need to be supported against the efforts of the United States. And so if America says we're going to depose Assad, that sort of opens the door for the Iranians to step in and take on the other side. An exception, an odd exception, but still consistent with this, is temporarily in Iraq, where both the United States and Iran are fighting ISIS. And ISIS, of course, is a Sunni organization. The difference there is, while it looks on the surface like we're on the same side with the Iranians, and that certainly seems to be what Washington is playing this as, the goals are very different. The U.S. wants to eliminate ISIS because we imagine them to be a global terror threat or whatever, even though they've never really acted outside of the area. The Iranians want to get rid of ISIS so that they can secure their hold over Iran and the Iranian government. So Iran is playing the big game quite well. They are interceding as they wish to. Some places it's money, some places it's special forces, some places it's weapons. Some places, like Iran, or Iraq, I should say, it's actual tanks and infantry. So they're doing the game, they're playing the game well, and they're playing it much more subtly than the United States. I think they also have a better sense of scale, if you will. America is trying to tries to connect everything to this global struggle against whatever the hell terrorism actually is. The Iranians, I think, understand that these, in many cases, are local struggles. Yemen, for example, that, you know, are treated as local struggles.
Right. And now, so what do you think about the power and strength of Hezbollah from, you know, as a consequence of fighting for all these years now against the American-supported jihadists in Syria? Because I guess the last time they really fought anybody was in 2006, so I guess that's battle experience for their officers. But now they're, you know, I don't know if they really have officers or how exactly they rank them in Hezbollah, but you know what I mean. The older guys had some experience, but now the young fighters do too, right?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on Hezbollah. I can only point out that they seem to still be there, and that in itself is something of an accomplishment. These organizations are much more amorphous than we like to do play them as. I mean, America often sees this all as a chessboard, and there's Hezbollah, and they're playing their chess game, and we're playing our chess game and things. But I mean, these organizations are loose. They kind of get stronger, they get weaker, they pair up with somebody for a while, and then they break off and do something else. You know, despite all the talk of caliphates and all this other stuff, I really don't know that these organizations are interested in governing in the traditional nation-state sense. ISIS does want to hold territory, but exactly towards what ends, I'm not sure. Whether they really want it as probably more of a sanctuary, if you will, than an attempt to create a nation state, you know, and someday be in the Olympics and have a flag and issue stamps and currency and stuff like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, now hold it right there. When we We got to go out to this break. When we get back, we'll talk about the Islamic State and their goals and America and Iran's relationship regarding all of that, etc. More with Peter Van Buren in just a minute, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/scotthortonshow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. On the line, I got Peter Van Buren, formerly of the U.S. State Department in the Iraq occupation. Now a peacenik writer type. Here he is at Tom Dispatch. Washington and Tehran come in from the cold. And so we're talking about the Islamic State. And, of course, America, there's been kind of a funny thing going on there where Iran and the U.S. have both been backing the same factions in Iraq since 2003, specifically the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigade and the Dawah Party, above all others, in their, you know, taking of Baghdad and the sectarian cleansing and all the rest of it, and refuse to talk to each other about this and coordinate this at all, really, even as they both basically had the exact same policy the whole time. And I guess maybe they took a break for a minute, but now they're back and they're doing the same thing, only they're pretending to not get along, or maybe they really aren't getting along. So you have the Quds force on the ground helping the Iraqi militias, the Shiite militias, into Crete, but then America at least supposedly refusing to back them up with air power as long as they're working with the Iranians. But now I guess there's a new order of battle where the U.S. in the air, the Shiite militias on the ground, commanded by Iranian special forces types, are attempting to attack Fallujah. And so now you have kind of, you know, maybe grudging outright coordination there against the Islamic State, although I don't know. How confident are you that they can take Fallujah, by the way? Sorry, that's kind of a digression, but I wonder if you think that's a fool's errand or what?
Sure. First of all, the idea that the U.S. is not coordinating with the Iranians is something that even the U.S. has kind of winked at publicly. There's been statements out of the Pentagon that while the U.S. doesn't interact directly with the Iranians on the ground in Iraq, we use the Iraqis as a pass-through, if you will. I mean, you could almost imagine this goofy setup where there's an American and an Iranian sitting at a table with an Iraqi guy in between them, and they're, you know, they're passing notes or something silly like
right,
that.
Like the Simpsons at dinner or something.
So the idea would be that if the Iraqis say, please drop a bomb on this location, and the U.S. does it, and that location happens to benefit the Shia militias or the Iranian ground forces, well, so be it. So I think we can all say we're all working together. Taking Fallujah and then its neighbor, Ramadi, is an interesting task, and we'll see how this plays out. Both of those are solidly Sunni cities. They're both large cities, and famously, of course, the United States basically destroyed a huge portion of Fallujah with untold civilian casualties in order to take it, if you will. Fallujah was never really pacified. The United States was dealing with a low-grade insurgency there, you know, right up until the time we pulled out. So in terms of driving ISIS out of that city, there's serious questions about whether anybody can do it. And if it can be done at all, it will probably involve destroying much of the city in order to save it, if you will.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so in larger strategic sense and this and that, You think Obama's really realigning things much more in favor of the Iranians? I mean, it's clear that the Iranian nuclear deal, or the nuclear issue, has been the gigantic outstanding issue, as fake as it's been, as you well document in your article. All they are doing under this deal is still not making nukes. Great.
Yeah.
Thank
We've
goodness
eliminated
for that,
weapons but, that don't exist. Yeah.
Right. But so we're lifting the sanctions, but that doesn't mean that politically Obama can't just go over there and shake hands with the Ayatollah, I guess, and this kind of thing. So how much of a redirection toward Iran do you think this really implies?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, and will probably rest more with the next president than Obama. As you said, this is just, an, if you pardon the pun, an opening shot. It was necessary for Obama to conclude this deal as a first step. He never could have taken any other steps without being able to have the political cover of claiming that he's dealt with the nuclear issue. I'm leaving aside right now the whole arguments about whether the Iranians will play along and all that other the stuff. But politically speaking, Obama had to say, check this box, if you will, before the next step. I suspect that the next steps will be small ones, you know, academic exchanges, a sports team, some cultural stuff. I mean, that's how these things are done, testing the waters. The Iranians are going to be expected to turn over the four Americans they have in their prison system right now. Obama won't be able to go too much further without something like that to show that there's some successes. And then after that, a lot depends on both the politics in the United States and also the way the Iranians want to play this. The Iranians know that if they want to move the ball forward with relations with the United States, they're going to have to give some stuff up, and it's going to have to be a public symbolic type thing that allows Obama or maybe the next president, you know, to say, look, this is working. This is happening. And let public opinion tap down the usual Republican outcries and demands, you know, that we start a new war every 3 weeks. We'll see what happens. Take a look back in the history books at the way Nixon and China played out. Everybody seen Forrest Gump knows that one of the earliest steps that was taken was to send ping pong teams over there and take their team over here. As signs of goodwill and just kind of get the machinery moving. We'll see what happens, but overall it's I think a hopeful sign. It's a first step, and you got to take a first step, and we'll see how committed the Iranians are and how much politically Obama thinks he can push on this.
All right, now the Saudi king announced the other day that he loves the nuclear deal. Good job, America, but seems like actually they don't really think that. Just how upset are they? I mean, I guess this means a lot more Iranian oil. Can you give us any kind of ballpark numbers? Do you know how much sure. Iranian oil is now going to be hitting the market and just how much that jeopardizes Saudi dominance in OPEC, et cetera?
The Iranians have the fourth largest proven reserves of oil in the world. And they have been prevented by sanctions from getting very much oil into the global markets. However, as we know with Iraq, who has the largest proven reserves of oil in the world, oil in the ground is not the same as oil for sale on the market. For Iran to really affect the global market for oil, it's going to have to do a number of things, and how long these things take will be where the magic is. First, its infrastructure has suffered greatly under sanctions. They are going to require literally billions of dollars of investment in order to bring their infrastructure up to modern standards and really be able to pump out oil. Whether they'll get that investment from Western oil companies or not is a question. Whether they'll be able to borrow the money from the Chinese is a question. The other thing would be that enough American sanctions have to be lifted to allow Iran to play in the global markets. Oil is sold in a global exchange. Obviously, side deals are made, but basically, if you've got a barrel of oil, you put it on a market, it's bid, And the deal is usually settled in American dollars. And those that when you're talking about those amounts, you know, you have to transfer those through the international banking system. Iran is cut off from all that right now by sanctions. And unless and until America removes those sanctions, they won't be a player. So it'll be a little while before they have any serious effect on the oil market. But obviously, the Saudis and others see where this could go and are going to be tracking that progress very, very carefully. Israel, of course, is not apologetic, if you will, or not conciliatory in any way whatsoever. They have basically predicted the apocalypse starting, you know, anytime this afternoon. So it's interesting to see the Saudis trying to take a little calmer play on all this.
Yeah, the apocalypse being, oh no, without the Iranian nuclear fake threat distraction, we might have to start talking about what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and we don't want that.
As well as losing a whole reason to keep their society 100% militarized forever.
Yeah, exactly. And on America's dole forever.
On America's dole. And, by the way, maintaining the Middle East's only nuclear arsenal.
Yeah. According to Daniel Ellsberg on this show, Mordecai Vanunu, the whistleblower, told him they have 600 nuclear weapons, including hydrogen bombs. And we know they have submarines, second strike, and all that.
Wouldn't surprise me.
All right. Hey, thanks very much for your time, Peter. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Peter Van Buren, everybody. TomDispatch.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Well, I can't just interview Patrick Coburn again because I just talked to him the other day, but you know who knows a lot about Turkey? Phil Giraldi. You know why? Because he used to be a CIA officer stationed there. Yeah, he's a former CIA guy, but he's pretty good on stuff, it seems like. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. And he writes at UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, and the American Conservative magazine at theamericanconservative.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. So all kinds of things are going on. The best that I understand, and you could correct me if you think that I'm wrong, and you just might, but the best I understand is that a Kurdish member, not of the PKK, but of the Islamic State, or at least that's the way they're saying it, now did a suicide attack in Turkey. And so then Turkey announced that they've decided they're switching sides in the war and now they're anti-jihadist. And so then they started bombing the PKK, the Kurdish communist guerrilla group.
Right.
And then maybe the Islamic State, some too, something. What the hell is going on over there?
Okay. Well, look, it's actually kind of easy to understand. Turkey's been sitting on the fence for a long time in terms of what's been going on in Syria, except that it's had a secret relationship with al-Nusra initially and more recently with ISIS. Now, this is easy to understand because Turkey doesn't give a damn about either of those groups. What it does give a damn about is the Kurds. What Turkey is totally paranoid about is the development of a Kurdish state in Turkey, in Syria, and Iraq. In other words, all of it, and in Iran, all of it coming together to create a Kurdish state. That's what Turkey is terrified about. So now, in this current situation, if you read the news accounts of who Turkey is attacking, they're not attacking ISIS, they're attacking the Kurds. And this is all, it all makes sense if one understands that the Kurds are the real enemy for the Turks. And so the whole ISIS thing is just kind of a sideshow, and the whole business with the Syrian government is pretty much a sideshow. What they are concerned about with the Syrian government is that the Syrian government will, in its death throes, permit the creation of a Kurdish state. It's all about a Kurdish state.
Yeah. Okay. Except they had a peace deal with the Turkish Kurds that's lasted for quite a long time, and I know they're all Kurds, but there's a lot of political division and tribal division among the Kurds too, and it's not like everybody's just ready to snap their fingers and join together into a Kurdish state. I mean, they're Turks too, in a way, right? I mean,
there are two different issues here. The peace treaty, it was a kind of a de facto peace treaty. It was never really that formal. Was with the PKK. Now the PKK is the Kurdish resistance movement that's basically in Syria and in Iraq. Within Turkey, there are a lot of Kurds. Some estimate that a third of the Turkish population is actually Kurdish. So there are two separate issues playing out here. Since the leader of the PKK was arrested by the Turks 15 years ago, there's been kind of a de facto on and off a non-aggression pact between the two of them. But my concern right now would be that the Kurds have shown that when they're pushed into a corner, what they do is they blow up tourists. And I think we can expect to see some bombs in tourist areas in Istanbul and along the south coast.
Hmm. Well, so do you think that the Islamic State sent a Kurdish member to go, like in the story here, to go and do this attack just in order to turn the Turkish state really more to their side, to actually give them an excuse to attack the Kurds, their enemies?
Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but the fact is the Islamic State is already on the Turkish side because many of the people resisting Islamic State are Kurds, are Kurdish militias. So it is a no-brainer for ISIS to want the Turks to start attacking the Kurds. The kind of joker in this deck is the fact that the United States will be staging attacks on ISIS simultaneously from the Turkish air bases that are NATO-controlled. Mm. So that's going to be happening too. But the fact is, if you want to understand where the Turks are coming from, you have to understand that the enemy is the Kurds. It's not Bashar Assad. It's not ISIS. It's not anything else. It's not Al-Qaeda. It's none of these groups. It's really the Kurds. This is the existential fear that drives the Turkish government, and this is why they behave the way they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, but that's what I meant, was the Islamic State sending a Kurdish guy to do the attack in order to give Erdogan an excuse to crack down on the Kurds, which he hadn't really been doing. He'd been supporting the Islamic State, I guess, somewhat, but I don't know to what
degree. Yeah, that's right. There were two incidents. There was a shooting incident in which a Turkish soldier was killed, and then there was the bombing incident, which I think killed two more soldiers or paramilitary policemen. And so there have been a couple of incidents, but you're quite right. It seems to me it is a provocation to turn the Turks loose on the Kurds, because the Kurds are the people that are most successfully resisting ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah.
Sense?
So Turkey is a NATO ally, and the U.S. doesn't let them get that far out of line here. This is American policy still is. They don't give a damn about ISIS or the Islamic State, either in Syria at least. They still, I guess, have the Kagan plan. They'd rather get rid of Assad before getting rid of Baghdadi.
Right. So the thing to watch will be to see just how effective or serious the U.S. Presence in Turkey turns out to be. Are they going to be pushing ahead? They're talking about something like a no-fly zone, a safe haven. I mean, that I think is kind of an irrelevancy. It's not really the policy. It's just to be doing something that looks cosmetic and looks nice. But that doesn't really advance anything.
Mm. All right, now, but so back to the Kurdish factions in Syria, Turkey, Iraq, etc. If the Assad government falls to whatever, Nusra or ISIS or whoever, and the Syrian Kurds have their own little semi-independent state, which they already kind of sort of have right now. That doesn't necessarily mean, does it, an immediate alliance and joining up with the Barzani clan in Iraq and the Declaration of Independence of Kurdistan. And then, I mean, obviously the Turks are terrified because it's Kurdistan takes up, you know, I don't know, you said the one third of the population, but it's about one third of the landmass of Turkey is Kurdistan too, right?
Right, that's true. But I would not be surprised to see some kind of political union between the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds, because there's a Kurdish nationalism is extremely strong.
Yeah.
And this, of course, would then suck in, you know, the Kurds who are located in Iran, which Iran no doubt is concerned about. And that's one of their concerns in terms of their own support for Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so this is a complicated kind of picture. It has often been noted that when Sykes-Picot treaty that created the modern Middle East, that with the Kurds were the guys that were left out. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see something coming together if there is a complete collapse of authority in Syria.
Mm. Well, and this is something that Rand Paul has called for, that we ought to promise the Kurds an independent Kurdistan, and never mind that would mean war with Turkey.
Yeah, that's right. Turkey would declare war on us. And of course Iraq would have problems with it too, our alleged ally. It's again one of these silly ideas that a guy like Rand Paul, who's better at doing eye operations than figuring out foreign policy, it's the kind of stuff he comes up with.
You know, is it really too much to ask that he just read his dad's column? I mean, come on.
He doesn't, apparently. That's part of the problem. His recent comments on the Iranian deal are pathetic.
And listen, the Kurds have a right to self-determination as individuals and as a people, if that's how they identify themselves. But it's not all things being equal here. There's a war going on and the promise of more wars. It's not like we're talking about how a peaceful separation could be negotiated in a perfect world or something like that. And
that's right.
I think the Kurds probably prefer the status quo to more of them being killed. Hang on a sec. We'll be right back, y'all. Phil Giraldi after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest, the American Conservative Magazine, UNS.com, UNZ, UNS.com. He's got a new one out at UNS, Israel's $100 million gamble. Jeez, I'd kind of like to talk about that. I haven't read it yet, but I think I know what you're talking about. But, still with the Turkey thing here for a minute. So, Phil, assuming that there's a policy that somebody could state in a paragraph at all, would you agree that, I mean, am I right? It seems like the policy is we'll bomb the Islamic State and we would prefer the Turks not really support them and we want to attack them, but we like al-Nusra now. And as long as al-Qaeda is doing our bidding, fighting against Assad for us, then we'll go ahead and let that. I mean, we're working with the Saudis from Turkey to support the new Army of Conquest. They're not even shy about it, right? Brookings guy Lister writing about it in the Washington Post and all this stuff. But so, as you mentioned earlier, though, the Turks have finally opened up the Incirlik, is that how you say it, airbase there in Turkey to let America fly more missions against the Islamic State in Iraq and presumably in Syria, too, where they're helping back the Kurds there. So... assuming what I just said made any sense at all, is that basically what's going on here, or do you think it's different?
Yeah, I think what you have to bear in mind here is that everybody that's playing in this poker game has a different agenda. And you just outlined that. I mean, basically, you know, who the Saudis are supporting are not necessarily who we would be supporting. The Turks are supporting people that we would not be supporting. The whole issue of replacing Assad is an issue on which there's not a total consensus. And then of course the war itself is as we were talking before, is a conflict that is intertribal in some ways in terms of how it pits groups against each other. So it's a god awful mess, and the only thing that obviously ties it all together is the fact that none of this would have ever happened if we had not invaded Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, got that right. All right, now, mm-hmm. But so come on, be honest with me about the authority of the CIA and the Americans in Turkey to say, hey, man, we don't want you to back this group of jihadis. We want you to back that group. They really say, screw you, Uncle Sam, we can do whatever we want? Come on.
Well, what they're doing is basically they're running these operations in a covert fashion. I have an article that's going to be coming up on the American Conservative this week called Deep State America. And I outlined that, you know, when basically the Turks, their version of deep state and our version of deep state, they kind of operate in the same way. They do things that go under the radar. And essentially these are things that they perceive or we perceive as being national interest, national security type issues. And the Turks do the same thing. I mean, they've been talking to these people. When I was in Istanbul last July, there were ISIS people in the streets collecting money. And this was very definitely against U.S. policy, and it was very definitely against what the Turkish government was actually saying.
Yeah. Now, so our friend Patrick Coburn here is saying, this is the dumbest damn thing in the world. I can't believe America has given the green light to the Turks to bomb the Kurds, because now what are the Kurds in Iraq saying? The Kurds in Iraq are saying, oh, now screw us, huh? I thought we were buddies, but now you're switching sides to Erdogan. I see how it is. And and yet that was the whole point of this war, was to keep the Islamic State out of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Well, see, the point is we're back down to the low level on this, which is where everybody has an interest in doing something that doesn't necessarily mesh with anyone else's interest. And the Iraqi Kurds, as long as we're giving them weapons and we're giving them money, are going to be our friends. But as soon as we stop doing that, they're going to say, hey, you guys stabbed us in the back. And this is how these things always play out. And when the fighting is over, if it's ever over, the Kurds are going to be looking to their own interests, and the Turks are looking to their own interests right now. So it's why should we expect anything different? We are the only country that doesn't actually do anything that's in its own interest.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's funny. There's this picture that goes around the internet sometimes. There's a couple different versions of it, I think, where it's like a letter to the editor of the newspaper saying, here, let me explain the Middle East real quick. And they explain which all countries hate which all other countries and back which all other minority factions in those countries and whichever, and how complicated it all is. But the thing is if you ever see it, it's completely out of date now. And because all those alliances are completely shifting and changing all the time. Like, I think it was originally written when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt. But don't worry, the Saudis and the Americans took care of that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically, you know, we fixed that situation in such a way that it's had consequences for the entire region. So, you know, another great victory for American diplomacy.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, you've been writing for years, especially every time the State Department report on terrorism comes out. Sure. You always give it a real critical read and report here. And, you know, oftentimes, as we've talked over the years, they're way overplaying the terrorist threat, so they have excuse to wage this stupid terror war. But then it seems like maybe now their interest more is in underplaying the amount that American policy, really, especially, obviously, as you said, this all flows from 03 on, has helped to spread, and really from 11 on, has helped to spread jihad all throughout North Africa. We got guys calling themselves the Islamic State in Nigeria, in Libya, in the Sinai Peninsula now fighting the Egyptians. Is that nonsense? These are just the same old militias that were always there and they got a new brand name? Or is this a real thing where the Islamic State, after all, their opponents are weak everywhere they go, so they're pretty weak too, but that doesn't seem to stop them.
Well, I think we have to. You have to look at it the same way we were looking at Al-Qaeda near the end. That basically it's a franchise, and these guys are using the name because the name has a certain cachet to it. But at the same time, they're not taking direction from. They're not necessarily getting money from. So it's the whole terrorism issue in every country, if you look at it carefully, is different. There are different social dynamics driving it. There are different resentments that are driving it. In most countries, it comes down to a type of civil war, if you really look at it. Mm-hmm. And they're all driven by local issues.
Good PR for them and good PR for us to oversimplify it and just rally around the black banner and all that.
Sure, sure. Like the latest country report on terrorism by State Department emphasized that now, okay, hey, last year was Al-Qaeda. This year it's ISIS. And boy, it's really bad. And of course, they always come out with, boy, it's really bad, because it justifies the government.
Right. Meanwhile, all the ISIS attacks here are all FBI plots. Not real ISIS attacks at all.
Well, that's been true since 2001, really. I mean, there have probably been, I think I did a summary of the attacks the last time I did a report on the country report. There was something like 38 Americans who've been killed by domestic terrorism of Islamic that can plausibly link to Islam. And one of them was, of course, the Major Hassan at Fort Hood. Mm-hmm. And I think there was another. Yeah, it was the Boston bombing. But all the rest of them were kind of plausibly maybe not so. So I said, essentially this is over the course of 13 years. Right. You have something like 2.1 people getting killed per year, and we're spending $1 trillion a year to fight it.
Right. Yeah, the only ones that were legit was Fort Hood. There was Zazi, yep, the cab driver from Denver. He was not entrapped. He was a real guy, but they got him before he did anything, and not through illegal spying either, but the old-fashioned way. And then there was the failure of the Times Square bomber and the failure of the Underpants bomber, and I think I'm out of examples. All the rest of them, bogus.
Well, the Boston Marathon.
Oh, and Boston, right. You mentioned Boston.
Yeah, but that's it. That's it. And we're talking about 13 years of spending $1 trillion a year, employing hundreds of thousands of people. We're intervening in countries all over the world. And, for this?
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
It seems like now,
do better than that.
It only now, after all this, only now have they really inspired the lone wolf attackers to finally come out, unentrapped ones, to come out and do like the Chattanooga shooting and a couple other things like that. And when the whole slogan for the entire project was, we have to fight them over there so that we don't have to fight them here, when clearly it's causing it,
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's been a fraud ever since the beginning.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks, Phil, very much for coming on the show. I got this lady reporting from East Africa here on the situation in Somalia coming up next.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yep.
Okay,
LRN.FM. Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Right.
All right, y'all, that's Phil Giralli. He's at the Council for the National Interest. He is at the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. We'll be right back in just a sec with Sadia Aden. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right. Well, dang, man. I'm sorry, you guys. The number that she gave me is ringing busy. I thought Sadia Aden on the show. So I'll either have her in 12 minutes or tomorrow, I hope. She was going to talk about Somalia. Perhaps will. Interesting. Actually, I prefer if I talk to her tomorrow now that I think about it, because I should read a bunch of her articles, or at least say the last three, right? I've really been falling down on the job. Well, I didn't know that she was doing the show until just now, and then actually maybe not. Razzle frats, man. All right, well, anyway. Man, I got tons of news to talk about here. Taliban frees 110 Afghan police after seizing key northeastern base. The police had been captured and disarmed after a three-day battle. Okay? What the hell is going on in Afghanistan? I turn around for 1 second, and all of a sudden the surge didn't work? Oh, wait, no. Sorry. Never did work. Taliban frees 110 Afghan police after seizing key northeastern base. Police were captured and disarmed after a three-day battle. After 3 days of intense fighting in Badakhshan, in northeastern Afghanistan, the Taliban overran a major police base, capturing 110 police in the largest surrender of Afghan forces in years. Police officials blame the government for the defeat, saying they didn't get sufficient reinforcements. Yeah, I think the headline was misleading. That was why I was confused. I mean, the war over there is disastrous enough. But for some reason, he just wrote freeze when he meant captured, because, hey, that happens. One time I meant to say that Paul Wolfowitz should be taken out and executed or something, but I said Glenn Greenwald instead. It was because I was reading a Glenn Greenwald article about what Wolfowitz had written. Or said, or whatever. And I didn't even realize it till I heard the recording later. And I was like, Glenn Greenwald ought to be taken out and shot. Don't! Is that what I said? I one time also said that World War II ended in 1846. Like, how in the world did I say that? Obviously, I'm even picturing the shape of the year 1946 in my head, which I have one. A shape for it. How in the hell did I say 1846? I'd say 45 anyway, and then I said 18 instead of 19, and I don't know. These things happen. We're just organic flesh and blood after all, guys. All right. After 3 days of intense fighting in Badakhshan in northeastern Afghanistan, the Taliban overran a major police base, capturing 110 police in the largest surrender of Afghan forces in years. The cops blamed the government for the defeat, saying they didn't get sufficient reinforcements. The surrender wasn't unconditional, however. And as agreed, the Taliban captured, disarmed, and ultimately released all the police. Oh, okay, see, I just needed to read the second paragraph. I don't know what the hell I'm saying on here. Before claiming the base for themselves, adding to their growing territorial possessions across northern Afghanistan. This is great. Anyway, so yeah. It's not great, it's horrible. It's going to be horrible for the people of Afghanistan, but... And you know what? I don't think they'll probably rule the whole place, but... They might. I wonder if Barack Obama would outright reinvade Afghanistan if the Taliban marched on Kabul. Or I guess there must be enough American air power to put a halt to a major advance, right? I guess they could just sneak in one at a time and then just declare themselves the ruler of the capital city and have a gun to everybody important's head. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to give him advice. But, you know, I said to Ann Jones one time on the show, she was in Afghanistan. And I says to her, I says... Hey, so yeah, what about the Taliban's gonna come back after the war's lost and all that? And she says, the Taliban's in Kabul right now, son. The Taliban's in the parliament. They're not the government, but they're part of it. Have been. Anyway. Huh. So. Yeah, what a disaster, man. I wonder if Obama will reinvade Afghanistan. He might have to. Oh, yeah. Nope, I already covered that. All right. Iran halts military aid to Hamas because of Saudi rapprochement. Saudi said to urge Hamas involvement in Yemen. Hamas officials are once again confirming that their military ties with Iran, a long-standing backer, are entirely halted. Apparently the result of Iran being unhappy with Hamas's political wing getting closer with the Saudi government, a key regional rival. Hamas was already starting to fall out of love with their place in Iran's orbit and vice versa, as the group fairly quickly bailed on its offices in Syria during the civil war, relocating its political offices elsewhere, mostly places like Turkey. Yeah, and they've sided outright from the very beginning with the rebellion in Syria, not with Assad. Hamas was already starting to fall, Hamas's struggles worsened with the 2013 military coup in Egypt, which installed a junta hostile to Hamas in power. Historically, Hamas has relied on Egyptian government to act as an intercessor with Israel, particularly during the semi-annual wars they seem to have with them. This forced Hamas's political leadership to seek an alternative for this role. They started cozying up to the Saudis, who are, of course, the ones who put dictator Sisi in power in Egypt anyway. Hamas military wing was said to not be keen on the idea, since this further alienated Iran, and the Saudis are not coming forward with military aid to replace them. Some reports are suggesting the Saudis are offering billions in financial aid to Hamas if they agree to formally end all military resistance to the Israeli occupation. And other reports suggest the Saudis are presenting as an alternative, sending Hamas's fighters to Yemen as a way to get them out of their hair. I don't know. You think, there are probably some dudes in Hamas who would take them up on that. You say we get how many billions? And I can live in Switzerland from now on? Oil-rich Saudi regime pledges $8.5 billion if Hamas Palestinian movement abandons armed resistance and sends militants to Yemen. I don't know if that's going to work. By the way, I finally started reading Max Blumenthal's book. I'm only just a few pages into it, and already I'm just shaking my head. For crying out loud, man. I mean, we ain't even got to the war yet. We're just talking about what is Gaza. Oh, man. Gaza's a tragedy. That's horrible. The 51-day war. I really like that Blumenthal, and I know that when it comes to domestic politics, he's very confused about different factions on the right and might even lump someone like me in with people where I don't belong lumped. But, you know, liberals never understand about libertarians, right? They never do. I don't care about that stuff. What matters is he is so good on Israel-Palestine. And this book, The 51-Day War, you should read it. It deserves a read. It's brutal, man. I swear to God, I'm like on page 7 or something. And just the quotes that he has of the Israeli officials saying, yep, this is what we do, all right. Oh, man. You know, it sounds like someone mocking them and putting words in their mouths, saying things that they would never say out loud. But, yeah, no, that's really their exact words. Are you kidding me? Good thing the Americans got their back. Otherwise, they could never get away with it. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys. Welcome back to the thing here, dude. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so I did reach her. Phone was ringing now. And she wasn't feeling too well. And we only had 10 minutes. And I only read one of her articles. And it wasn't even about what's going on. And I think she preferred. And so I decided, yeah, let's do it tomorrow. So tomorrow we'll have Sadia Ali Aden on the show to talk about what's going on in Somalia. It's so important. I know you don't care about Somalia, but you gotta care about what America's doing to Somalia. You see how now it matters? What America's doing to the people there? Now it matters. I know it's far away and sounds like, well, I care about Somalia. Cause it's sort of, kinda, just a tiny bit in a way, if you believe in that kind of thing, your responsibility. So tomorrow she'll be on the show to talk about that. And it's going to be horrible. All right. Oh, you know what? Man, now I wish I'd kept Phil on the show because... But that's all right. I'm going to have Weiss tomorrow, I think. Oh, wait. I didn't hear back from him, did I? That poor guy just wants me to leave him alone, I guess. But Phil's got a new piece here. Israel's $100 million gamble. The lobby doubles down on its propaganda war. Got that right. And that is what I should talk about as I was, you know, blindly kind of stumbling around here wondering about what to talk about for this last segment on the show. Here's some things I've been meaning to get to that you might agree are important. All right, so, and this is a little bit redundant, but I don't care, it's the thing. Netanyahu offers simple explanation of what the Iran deal should be. And what he says is dismantle for dismantle. But that's what we have. They dismantle their nuclear program to a degree, and we dismantle the sanctions to a degree. But no, his answer is you got to just keep going and keep going and keep going forever until they don't have a nuclear program anymore. So now you see what's going on here. We've bumped right up against nonsense. Stop lying. Stop making me have to agree with stupid freaking John Kerry, who I hate. There is not a nuclear deal that can be made that will result in Iran abolishing its entire nuclear program. That is just not going to happen. The only way for them to not have a nuclear program at all is for America to invade and conquer the country, which we may not actually be able to do. You put your entire armed forces over there. Okay. It's going to be really horrible, though. That's what they're saying. Or actually, you know what they're really saying is, other than just they want a war, they're calling you stupid. You ever notice that about the war party? They never are honest, ever. Hey, all we're saying is we want a good deal and not a bad deal. Yeah, but they know that their definition of a good deal is impossible. And so, what are we talking about? Is it possible that what you call a bad deal actually ain't so bad? Nope, let's not even talk about that. It's treason. Oh, you're putting all the poor Jews of Israel right into the Iranian Holocaust oven, cries Mike Huckabee. When actually what the deal does is it requires that the Iranians stop enriching any nuclear material whatsoever at their Fordo facility, scale back their Natanz facility from 20,000 spinning centrifuges down to 6,000, unplug the rest, dismantle them in a way where it would take a long time to get it up and going again, a real long time. Completely convert the Arak, A-R-A-K, Arak reactor, so that it cannot produce weapons-grade plutonium, which they don't even have the facility to reprocess the waste from that facility into nuclear weapons fuel anyway, but anyway. And expand inspections beyond all reason to all kinds of facilities where there is no nuclear material or where it's still just being mined right out of the ground, refined into yellow cake before conversion into uranium hexafluoride gas, etc. So they're signing their additional protocol and the subsidiary arrangements and agreements and every other thing that they can do in coming to terms with the IAEA and the global nonproliferation regime to prove that they are not making nuclear weapons. That's what the deal is. Oh no, Obama's just handing them nukes. What are you, stupid? You let Israel tell you wrong things to believe and repeat? God dang. I would be upset, you know? Hey, who's that foreigner move my lips? Oh, it's Israel. They've flown in $100 million gamble, Phil calls it, from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, JTA.org. AIPAC fly-in launches major push against Iran nuclear deal. Hundreds of pro-Israel activists from across the country will descend on Capitol Hill next week to press members of Congress to reject the nuclear deal with Iran. The July 28th through 29th fly-in, which will bring to this city some of the most dedicated of the 100,000-strong membership of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is part of a multi-pronged effort by the pro-Israel lobby aimed at killing the agreement reached July 14th between Iran and the world powers. The campaign, according to top pro-Israel officials who briefed reporters on Wednesday, will also include TV ads by a new AIPAC-backed nonprofit dedicated to killing the deal. Calls and emails by activists to their congressional representatives and attendance at town hall meetings lawmakers are expected to convene during the August congressional recess. Now, so that's their right to do it. They're Americans and they're participating in democracy. And if you want to stop them, you better get to making some phone calls and faxes of your own. I think the Democratic Party is probably not going to help the Republicans override the president's veto and kill this deal. But then again, they might. And the Israel lobby, they're not everything, but they are highly organized and they have long memories, and congressmen who cross them find themselves unelected. Happens all the time. And the congressmen know that. So now, you know, backstabbing the President of the United States on a great foreign policy achievement, that's probably not very good for your reelection chances either when you're in the same party as the president there. But that's the only question for these Democratic members of the House and the Senate. Which is going to hurt my reelection chances more, crossing Obama or crossing Israel? Obama's going to be gone. Israel's going to hang around. AIPAC is going to be around. Although, as mentioned yesterday on the show, we were talking about that article at Jim Loeb's blog with Grant Smith, where Chris Nelson, who is a very influential Washington insider with a high-cost subscription newsletter, is quoting an AIPAC official, a former AIPAC official, saying that, in essence, no Iranian enemy, no AIPAC. If Obama can make peace with Iran, never even mind Israel, right? Just the Israel lobby itself. War is the health of the Israel lobby. Conflict is the health. That's what they're about. And if America has a thawing relationship with Iran, now what are they going to do? Accuse the Palestinians of stealing and occupying Israel? Why, there are Palestinian settlements all over the West Bank. How dare they? Actually, that'll probably get him pretty far. I don't mean to give him ideas. Stupid as that sounds. So they have their very own, very selfish interest in pushing this deal. But meanwhile, again, not that this counts. It's all about who does the work, not just, you know, who answers the poll. But the LA Jewish Journal did a survey. And American Jews want Congress to approve the Iran deal, and compared to the American population, even more than the population at large. They're Democrats. They support the president. And they believe the president when he says, hey, this is in Israel's long-term interest. I'm trying to super-duper extra guarantee the civilian nature of Iran's nuclear program. So you believe me or not? And they believe him. And he's not lying. And the Israeli security establishment, as reported by The Forward, agrees too. All the former leaders of Mossad and Shin Bet, they all agree. It's just the politicians and the hawks and the charlatans who want to kill the deal and have a war.